Hello. Sorry about a couple of days late. And all things that I've been busy. Been a busy boy. Been a busy bee. Been doing the very extensive rewrites on my book. We've extended the deadline once again. And it's just kind of diverted my attention away from my beloved, which is anyone who listens to this, because I am easily bought. My love is easily gained. Just say I'm the most important person in your life. Bam, I'm there. So I've got to talk about a few different things. I was going to start off by, I was recently talking to people about 2016, when I was in the midst of active addiction. I was buried alive in a troubled relationship and in between 14-hour care shifts and heavy drug use, half a bottle of 10 milligram 1 milliliter oxycodone oral solution, an entire bottle of 10 milligram 5 milliliter Oramorph, 60 times 30 milligram dihydrocodone tablets in one go. I obsessively catalogued Trump's mind-warping narcissism as, you know, his prodigious ascent to the top of the Republican ticket and finally the presidency. I've actually got two framed Time magazines with Trump on the cover on my wall to shit people up. Like, if anyone comes round, no one comes round. If anyone comes round, no one ever comes round. If anyone comes round, yeah, I had like with my ex-girlfriend, she's very, you know, like me, very progressive. I bought her an AOC t-shirt that she asked for. And she was like an arts and crafts type person, had her own theatre company. And I put these on the wall to kind of shit her up. But I said, see, it represents a time in my life, where the bad energy of my drug using, my prodigious drug using at the time, the worst it got. Like, this was, I completely bottomed out. This was my bottom. But my bottom manifested itself in a way that was, it wasn't like killing someone with my car or hitting someone. It was nothing. It was just as I said before, just me sitting in a lounge. And that's all she wrote. Like, that is it. I just stopped. My bottom was, yeah, I mean, it was just, my life had ceased. My life was on pause totally. I was doing nothing apart from taking drugs and obsessively cataloguing Trump's ascent, Trump's history warping narcissism, the kamikaze mission we called Brexit, the failed Turkish coup d'etat, the rise of Rodrigo Duterte. I like to, like, Mgagwe as well, Zimbabwean. The Wayans brother of Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwean president, because I worked for someone who's from Zimbabwe, worked for three people from the Philippines. I used to talk about the Romanians, about Ceausescu. I like to talk about global events, and I like to have that as a point of entry. And I was talking for the people I work for. That's why multicultural workforces are banging, mate. Honestly, it's like when people, you know, the thing people say, familiarity breeds contempt. I've always thought the opposite. And the thing I use as an example of that is when Big Brother used to be on and you see them all come in, like 80% of them from their videos, you're like, what a fucking dickhead. Oh, God, what an absolute prick. I've got to deal with this one for like a couple of months now. And I always got to the end and had an affection for nearly all of them. They'd sometimes be real villains, but like they're, I usually felt some kind of kinship or connection. And there's a flattening effect or a homogenizing effect with working in a multicultural workforce that the sort of behaviors or attitudes that have social roots and roots connected to their own countries, or there's culinary or political divisions, you know, there's difference, but you learn to embrace the difference, and then you still, at the end of the day, all laugh at a news story about a mentally ill man punching a baby because he thought it was a dolly. And that was one of those moments where we said it, and we said, like, the reality of that story is horrific. But I remember all of us laughing, even the ones who were, like, older, and you would expect to be kind of horrified by that. They laughed despite themselves, and it was like a giddiness that you get from taboo humour. And it's just, yeah, it was quite, it had like a leveling effect. It was like, oh, we're all just people, aren't we? Which is ridiculous that you need that to be confirmed. And it's a bit hippy dippy, you know, all hands together bullshit. But I like a multicultural workforce. But there was ethnic tensions. There was racial tensions. I'm seeing it a lot more in the home I'm in now, which is for people with special needs. And you have, the English workers, mix of races. But then you have another splinter group not splinter groups, haven't broken off from that group. You've got the British workers, and then you've got a contingent of African workers. And there's a massive divide between it. I mean, I rise above it. I'm above the parapet, because I'm only there as an agency staff. Like, I'm not part of the internal politics of this place. I just observe it from the outside. But yeah, it's the kind of weird standoff. I mean, they do get along and have a laugh and stuff, but then it can get a bit standoffish whenever it exacerbates, when pre-existing tensions are exacerbated by something very trivial. You realise, like, buried deep is these divisions between the English carers and the four African carers. But yeah, I don't know enough about it. I mean, it's like the report yesterday, which, as Femi said, is on Twitter, like, it was dripping in conservative ideology, and it's not. As if anyone's gonna say that's definitive, when someone else on Twitter said, "Wait, let me get up." Quite a funny tweet from someone here. One sec. I'm just finding it. It's all part of it. It's all part of it, mate. It was saying along the lines of, the UK evaluated the UK and found that the UK was the best of the world. The UK reviewed the UK and found the UK was the best, from Blixberry. So, to anyone use that as a kind of bipartisan thing is just ridiculous. So during this period in 2016, I also continued my lifelong habit of journaling. And in that article about Puritans, I think I read about recently, Malcolm Gaskill, in an essay entitled At the House of Mr. Frog, he said many Puritans made records of their lives, which, far from being vain indulgences, were scribal acts of contrition, reflexive aids to contemplation. And Michael Wigglesworth, who was a Puritan minister, wasn't being falsely modest when he called himself a poor, sinful worm. And as my cratering existence was limited to care work, drug use, and voraciously consuming world events to escape the tedium of life, most of it was about that. Here was some choice entries. So, number one, it's from a newspaper article. It said, boys born in London's Chelsea can expect to live nearly 9 years longer than those born in Blackpool. And then me saying, what does that final years look like? I saw an elderly man offer a balled up lump of shit to a visiting dog. The Chelsea boys can have their 9 years. And isn't it funny? And isn't it funny that we call it Remembrance Funny? Remembrance Day. When most of the people we're honoring can't even remember not to shit themselves. Which is very wrong. It's just such a disrespectful joke, but that's part of the. But the book, I think I demonstrate enough self awareness in the book to get that sort of stuff over to the. There is many selves that we put forward. So well, actually, I'll read from that bit actually about relational interact. So. Different social selves. Like I've got a self that is a sort of sado trickster self. Where I want to undermine. I know it's appropriate. I know it's appropriate, but it's like I'm not free of guilt when I submit to this sado trickster pope. I know it's wrong and I should probably rein it in a bit, but there's always like a complicated negotiation, isn't there, between freedom of speech and social responsibility, between liberty and decency. I'm sure Frankie Boyle, who now seems to be a thoughtful, progressive man in a lot of ways, though there are some bits that he's... There's some bits that I think he should pay penance for that he hasn't. Some horrible ways he's written about certain people I know and really respect. But anyway, I'm not here to make judgment, but I'm sure he thinks of Kieran Smith and his daughter as well. So Kieran Smith wrote the book, The Politics of Down Syndrome, because Frankie Boyle was sort of put on the spot at a gig and started making jokes about someone with Down syndrome, which is, he probably did the right thing. He didn't want to break the act. He didn't want to break the persona he's cultivated on stage. So he lent into it rather than being apologetic, which I think would have waylaid the gig. But at what point do you relinquish the opportunity to make a joke and just instead be a human, be, you know, or compassionate? I'm not making a judgment either way. Like we're often troubled by two conflicting, though concurrent, viewpoints. Is it an innocuous joke, unable to cause any real harm? I think that's how I would have tried to justify it in my head. Say, are they really injured by this? Or have I actually underestimated its negative potential? You know, you could ruin someone's day. Clive Baldwin, in an essay entitled Narrative and Decision-Making, writes that in comedy, there is hope for the hero in a temporary triumph over darkness. What I've said before about catharsizing experience and temporarily draining it of its misery. And that the essential difference between tragedy and comedy is the depiction of human nature. Tragedy shows greatness in human nature and human freedom, whereas comedy shows human weakness and human limitation. The purpose of comedy is to make us laugh and at the same time to help us illuminate human nature and human weaknesses. And you can't get any weaker than being a pillow on an ear. And that's because I said when Gilbert, who was double amputee, when he had his second leg amputated, I said to the assembled workers, at the rate he's going, soon we're going to be drip feeding an ear on a pillow. At least it won't shit as much, which is horrible. Part of life, though. Sometimes you make these jokes. Sometimes there's a cruelty in all of us. I think it is. I don't know why people try and deny that part of themselves. When people get, you know, holier than thou and a bit self-righteous on Twitter, which really lends itself to that for some reason. Just even a second, just a moment of self-awareness. Like I said, with this guy, Josh Berry does impressions and he's like a real, like he was born deep throat in a fucking silver spoon. And he's doing like a pasty or kind of more. I mean, when he's like taking the piss out of people, cuts have got cross class, but there's not even a moment. There's a point where if you're at a certain vantage point and you're making jokes, it's just like a king pissing on paupers. And I don't think that's what satire is for. But if he just demonstrated just a second of self-awareness or just a moment of acknowledgement that he was in the most privileged part of one of the most privileged schools in the country. I think it was, I don't know what they've got different houses, didn't they? Like Hogwarts. His name was, someone wrote about it yesterday. So I think he was at Cambridge. And Cambridge, funnier watching this when you bear in mind that Josh went to Reading Blue Coat School and Oxford University. It's always fun to see stand-up comedians at the beginning stages of Twitter reactionary radicalization. In a couple of months, we're going to see him on TriggerPod or Andrew Doyle's GB News. I could probably go down that route. I couldn't do that kind of stuff, like chest forward. Not that they would ever ask me, but I wouldn't rule it out. I would do it because I suppose there's a thing in me that thinks whatever opportunity I'm offered, I can make it my own. I can put my own little mark on it. I could do it right. But just some of these things are so highly politicized and very kind of nailed in political agenda that just by being on it, people assume that it's an implicit endorsement of that political agenda. So yeah, I'm a fan of chatting, man. I'm a big fan of chatting, especially when it's deep therapeutic conversation. I like the satisfying synergy that occurs when two people are igniting something in each other and blasting down to the substratum, clearing away the part of themselves that conforms to social manners so we can peer at the shriveled penis of objection. It's common knowledge, writes Eric Berggren in The Psychology of Confession, that talking about painful and disturbing memories or experiences which have lain in our minds unburdens us of them and affords us a sense of relief. According to Peter Tyler in Confession, The Healing of the Soul, philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, whose book I've got it's a weird old book. I started to understand it was full of, sorry, it's, oh no, that's that. One sec, sorry. No, I can't find it now. It's, kind of just a book of notes that he can never. He tried to turn into like a coherent exegesis, but he never could. So it just remained a book of notes about the uses of language. And philosophy, I would always find hard. I'd find it hard to get my head around it. But then yesterday, when I was reading Existentialists and Mystics by Iris Murdoch, which is writing some philosophy and literature, and it made it clear that there are different styles. So there's a question of style, of written style within philosophy. So different philosophies, different philosophers have their differing styles. And metaphysics and epistemology will have its own voice, often immediately recognizable. In turn, there have been among philosophers, literary masters. So as at the outset, so ancient Greek thought did not separate the poetic from the philosophical. So this stuff, you're like, the Lucretius, like on the nature of things, you think it's a poem, but no, it's also a philosophical tract. It's the two weren't mutually exclusive. And the poem, as in the case of Parmenides or Empedocles, was a legitimate means of philosophic argument, even of a technical nature. They said, with the exception of formal and symbolic logic or analytic studies on the foundations of mathematics, all philosophy is part of the natural language. And Lucretius and Dante inherited this unison between poetry and philosophy. And then prose came to prevail in philosophy, but in different ways. So Plato was a dramatist of reason. So in Plato, doesn't he do, isn't it like a play about Sophocles? I think Plato, Sophocles. Think Socrates, I mean. So yeah, within a play written by Plato, he speaks as Socrates within the play. So he's basically writing a play of like someone who's inspired him, Socrates. It's like me writing, you know, a play about Stuart Lee talking about the nature of comedy or something. I think that aspect of it was quite meta. I found confusing. And then the most characteristic of French prose remains Cartesian to this day. So, and then Nietzsche compelled Germans to clarities, and there was a lyric terseness which few other writers have matched in Nietzsche's writing. And there is something eerie in the aphorismic inventiveness, the almost surrealist wit of Wittgenstein's pictures and thought experiments. So pictures, that's what the book I've got is. It's a load of little, like aphorism, little thought experiments. Just like blah, 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 like one to all numbered. So yeah, that was eye-opening. Now I feel like I've got, I can get into philosophical writing, because it isn't all just po-faced analysis. It's like, you know, I could be a philosopher. I might do the Stuart Lee book. Stuart Lee, I might give him a walk-on part in my book. He's doing a cover quote, which is nice of him. And so, and Wittgenstein was an inveterate confessor. And in that other book I read, like, there is an art to confession. And that's what I think. That's a big part of my personality, is confession and full disclosure. And the ablution ritual, the purification ritual you have from offloading this stuff and just being honest about, you know, you, no hidden agendas with stuff. When you write, you know, you sometimes write stuff on Twitter under the guise of like, oh, this is just a bit of a self-effacing humor, it's a self-denigrating humor or whatever, but then really you're doing it to boost your own status. Really, you're doing it to say, like, secretly, oh, this is how busy I am and how many different projects so poop have always got to go. They just tell people that. Not in that way. Not black. Tell people that, biscuits. I'm eating a biscuit now. Be honest. But rather than a distraction, confession for Wittgenstein becomes the essence of what it is to be a human being. It's like pushing a soil sampling probe into the depth of your soul, pulling it out again, and running some nutrient-rich analysis on, like, the little cylinder that comes up for air, penetrating things in their full existential reality. Or another aspect of conversation I like, when the, you know, when, like, the free improvisation of a discussion momentarily finds its coherence, and you know, we're bonding, we're riffing, it's really gelling, before turning into the judge of an awkward goodbye. And it's usually has that when it's collaborative. Like, I don't like one-upmanship. I don't like being in a green room with a load of mainly male comics. Everyone trying to one-up each other or out-funny each other. I like it when we're all building upon an established narrative. I used the example of when Davy Jones, you know, the brilliant Davy Johns, is it? The one who was in I, Daniel Blake. He's a comedian, and I performed with him at Glee. There was me, Spencer Jones, Adam Rowe, and Steve Hughes, and Davey. And Davey did a riff in the bar at like 3 a.m, where he was doing a cheap, cheesy, like infomercial for a roller disco. Like, hi, I'm Dave, and we're here. Like, we kept contributing to it and building upon it, this established premise. And it was just really funny. It was just like really funny and warm and generous. Like, when that's what I like, if you're going to do that sort of stuff. As a comedian, you're always aiming for that sweet spot, like just before, like as it's all gelling. And for this, I'm glad to be part of a world full of relational beings. And like, they're putting aside all the gratitude bollocks for a second. When I'm on stage, no one in the room is allowed to talk unless spoken to. You're going to sit, you're going to laugh, that's it. But we're all going to pretend there's an even reciprocity between us anyway. I'm joking. Unlike a lot of comedians, I actually encourage unsolicited interaction in my shows. At Hot Water Comedy Club in Liverpool, which is a brilliant club, I did a work in progress show that turned into like a semi-intervention. The only people in the audience were 8 drunken aunties and 1 sweet, timid man. And after banding my prepared material, I remained seated on a stool under a spotlight while the aunties expressed genuine concern for my welfare and provided me some decent life advice. Once the show, in the loosest sense possible, had finished, they cuddled me as I was leaving. It was wonderful. And if any of the audience happened to be, if any of you ladies happen to be listening to this, please reach out and reach out to me on Twitter at Pope Lonergan, because I've got such warm memories of that. I love that. It's a lot of drug addicts. We recognise that part of the reason we abuse substances is to restore a sense of connection with other people, but by using, and the antisocial lifestyle that comes with it, the sense of termination with the wider society becomes more entrenched. This is compounded by a pandemic. Whether the dislocation is self-enforced or whether it has social roots, you end up creeping around the edges of the day, itching and sweaty, smelling like dog feet, which smell like biscuits. Only emerging to procure more pills, more tar, more powder, whatever it takes to combat a boredom rooted in a fundamental discomfort of the self. So Gabor Mate, in the book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounter of Addiction, which I urge all of you to read to understand every perspective like on addiction, the spiritual, philosophical, the biomedical, even I've got problems with that. The neuroscientific is what I've got problems with. I'll get to that one sec. And so, yeah, I mean, that drug addicts. I mean, Gabor Mate thinks that we condemn the addicts' struggle, refusal. We condemn the addicts' stubborn refusal to give up something deleterious to his life or the lives of others. Why do we despise, ostracize, and punish the drug addict when, as a social collective, we share the same blindness, engage in the same rationalizations? To pose that question is to answer it. We despise, ostracize, and punish the addict because we don't wish to see how much we resemble him. In his dark mirror are our own features are unmistakable, but we shudder with recognition and we're like, fuck that, this mirror is not for us, we say to the addict. You, get back, mate, you've got 4 teeth, you're whistling like a tea whore, you're whistling like a fucking kettle whore. You're whistling like a pig in lava. I don't fucking know. You're whistling like a poofter. I was about to do a really like a really awful, outdated, offensive impression of a 1950s confirmed bachelor. And I apologize for saying poofter. I meant it to be like obviously not right. So the old Nim firm are another reminder of our mortality, of the continuous thread that runs throughout our lives, also known as our personhood. But the parts of it that are fraying, that are weak, and that could break at any moment. That's why they've been shunted into the care homes, which have been eroded by the economic forces of austerity and capitalism, which for many years were ignored by the chattering classes. You give a shit. And why would you want to integrate these people when they're such a stark reminder of our fallibility? This is my main reason for feeling so comfortable kicking back with the dementias. There might be differences in our subjectivity or our capacity for rational thought, but we're all sidelined. We're all considered a burden. What should outlaws, pariahs, and desperados do when they find each other? Band together, start a gang. And insignia is two syringes crossing each other, one full of heroin, the other full of Ovaltine or insulin, because they have a lot of that because they're fat and old. It's time to get fat and old. Life's been bleak and you feel shit. So eat those biscuits till you shit. Fat and old, fat and old, fat and old, fat and old. La 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 la. Yeah, right. In 2016, and I was in the midst of active addiction, and Trump's prodigious ascent, the top of the Republican ticket. I think I've done this bit. Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah, for writing. So some of the entries from my, this is my cratering existence, where it was limited to care work, drug use, and voraciously consuming world events to escape the tedium of life. So most of it was about that, but there was one, here's some entries from it. I'll read the one about boys born in London's Chelsea can expect to live nearly 9 years longer than those born in Blackpool. But what does that final 9 years look like? I saw an elderly man offer a balled up lump of shite to a visiting dog. The Chelsea boys can have their 9 years. And isn't it funny that we call it Remembrance Day, when most of the people we're honouring can't remember not to shit themselves. Number two, personhood. I'm doing nothing. If they use me as a case study, would I withstand a forensic legal analysis that's trying to determine whether I am technically a person? In uni, my close friend's dad died. He was in serious coal black mourning. Couldn't be alone at night, so he moved into my room. We tried sharing a bed for a while, but he was a big boy and a fidget. He decided to move to the floor. I decided to move him to the floor. Once when I was drunk on 50p cans of Frosty Jacks, he was sobbing on the floor. In a misguided attempt to alleviate his grief, I stood on the bed, pulled back my foreskin and urinated all over him. I pissed on a grieving man in an effort to provide some much needed levity. It was a mistake. Number four, Hutterites. And in this book, I read about the Hutterites counter the sinful world with a dark pessimism. An awareness of their own mortality overshadows their lives. And then I made a joke, which was, I like my Anabaptists like I like my women. Completely devoid of any life-enhancing qualities. It's the joke. And I'm a rabble-rouser. I remember this. I'm a rabble-rouser. I'm a crusader. And because I work with a lot of immigrants, I'm constantly pushing back against management because of how they treat these staff members. During a conversation about the immigrants' financial hardship, I accidentally started a flyering company for pints, my comedy night pints, my pro-comedy night pints in Southend-on-Sea, which I will resume at some point. I accidentally started a flying company to financially support my Romanian colleagues who were struggling to pay rent, etc. I ended up paying 90% of my income to my colleagues to fulfill my stated commitment. And I put myself in a position where I had to get out a loan in order to pay my own bills just because I wanted them to think of me as their champion. I was high at the time. And number six, I wish geriatrics had self-cleaning arses. Outside of work and my mum, dad and girlfriend, my social life had completely evaporated. I wasn't even seeing my three closest friends who I've known since I was 2 years old. And if we understand that individuals can extract meaning in their lives by existing in a network of relationships, a matrix of dependency. And if we're saying if you can extract me from the life books, but existing within a network of relationship, major in my life. My boring old life was intersecting with very few other people's at this point. We understand that individuals construct me by existing within a network of relationships, a matrix of dependency. My boring old life was intersecting with very few other people's at this point. The people I was engaging with, those who ended up being a regular fixture within a given week, took on an outsized role in my personal narrative. And these weren't intimate. So the people I was engaging with, though they became a regular fixture in my life, they took on an outsized role in my personal narrative, even though they weren't intimates. I didn't even know their names, but they entered stage left and had an impact. And I was starting to understand what it must be like for the elders. You know, we become really important key figures in their lives, but sometimes they don't even know our names. And Tom Kitwood, who's one of the most influential writers on dementia, particularly in the field of person-centered care, had ideas about personhood that didn't necessarily derive from abstract philosophical analysis, for he was always striving for an understanding that had real-world application. And in Tom Kitwood on Dementia, A Reader and Critical Commentary, in a chapter entitled Personhood, Alison Finney writes, for Kitwood, personhood lies at the meeting point between three discourses, transcendence, ethics, and social psychology. And focusing in on the latter, with personhood, a process grounded in social interaction, she identified with personhood And focusing on the latter with personhood being defined as a process grounded in social interaction, she identifies that our assigned roles aren't always fixed, determinate categories. So positioning oneself and others in interaction is not necessarily intentional, nor is it necessarily consistent. It is a dynamic process that positions not only the other, but also relative to that positioning oneself. So, for instance, me and Louis have been friends since we were, you know, trapped in a punnet of other babies together. Like, we've a lot of little babies squidged together. The dynamic that we'd always use and we sort of cultivated ourselves was that I was always striving for love and affection, and he, he like we were both eternally bound to each other. But he was sort of like indifferent to me. But underneath it all, there was real love. But like on the surface, he was kind of indifferent and was always kind of shrugging off my campaign of to gain his affection and his love. But as we've got older, in certain social situations, when it's just us two together, it's fine. But in certain social situations, I don't want to play that role because it's emasculating. And I'm a man now, and then a man who's, you know, accomplished in some rights, like both of us are. We're both doing things. We're both getting on in life. And I'm no longer happy to play those assigned roles in a public setting. And it's good. It's like my other really close mates is Michael Louis and Jack Jenkins, and then Jack McKechnie as well. My mate Jack Jenkins, who's had his own problems with mental health and that, has really just flourished totally in the last couple of years, and he's now at university and he's studying psychology and mental health and stuff like that. And he was really discerning. He was really he clocked that I wasn't at ease with, I wasn't comfortable with that dynamic anymore. And so when like Louis, his family, and like my surrogate family, I love them to bits, but when we were all playing a quiz and Louis and his brother were kind of treating me like the, you know, like the whipping boy, I just was getting great. I couldn't pinpoint why, but I was getting gradually more and more frustrated. And in the end, I just ended up like stropping off the quiz, like, you know, the quiz call, because and now realize why. It's because I've outgrown that role. But it's hard to move beyond that when it's been it's so deeply entrenched. It's been ever since, you know, we've developed as human beings together, me and Louis, we've grown in unison, and we went through years of being just like Siamese twins, being like absolutely attached to the hip, that I think is going to take actually having a conscious, like having a proper sit down conversation and spelling that out, because I'm sure there's ways that I sort of speak to Louis or treat Louis that he's no longer comfortable with. He feels he's outgrown it. So in this period of active addiction, it went on for about 5 years, but the worst of it was between 2015 and 2017. And back then, I also did 3 14-hour shifts per week, which was Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. So the remainder of the week off. My ex-girlfriend was working a typical 9 to 5 job. Girlfriend working. And with her working that typical 9-to-5 job, there's a lot of time spent on my own, sitting in a tiny room above a nightclub and next door to a drug dealer's flat. Our flat was nicely furnished. She turned it into the best possible version of itself. But being one of those tiny places above a row of high street shops with a view of a broken street lamp and a betting shop, had that atmosphere you couldn't purify despite coiling fairy lights around everything. There's a guy who worked in a news agency and sold me vodka. The only time I left the house, he was next to a larger convenience store with cheaper vodka, but I couldn't do it to him. It had the flavour of betrayal. I'd come in and at the same time every day in jogging bottoms and Aphex Twin t-shirt, a turquoise Harrington with a glossy 4-foot plait hanging from my emaciated limescale head. Before I'd even spoken, he'd said, "Morning, boss," and reach behind him and plonk down a 35 centiliter bottle of Glen's onto the countertop. And I always convinced myself that that would be enough and always went back for more, but at the cheaper convenience store, which stayed open later. So we'd never know. Devious. Shoot me like a knowing smile and a conspiratorial nod of the head. And I interpreted the gesture as like there's no shame in being a pisshead. Pisshead. Didn't catch your name. We'll call you pisshead. No shame in being what you are, pisshead. Just be careful. Keep your nose clean. Stay out of trouble. And no matter what happens, I'll always be here for you. Hand on the tiller. Guiding you to safer waters. Also, I love you and always will. Which was probably me projecting, but for some reason, even though he was enabling me for profit, I was comforted by him. Much like I am to the residents. He was a constant, steady presence, a guardian, but one who happened to facilitate my alcoholism. And I picked up a few of these over years. They come into my orbit, but in some instances, the roles have been reversed and they're the one looking for love or friendship or simply someone to talk to. Like the man in the X30 bus I'd travel home from work with, usually if I was only doing like an early Friday shift. Before he introduced himself to me, I'd seen him initiate conversations with fellow passengers, and they were always reluctant to participate, knowing they'd be trapped in this interaction. And he was 66 years old, with a large hooked nose, the tip of which had a constellation of burst capillaries. He was very like raw boned and skinny, and he hiked almost everywhere. I'd see him traversing the fields of Rawruff, like a nomad, which is why I've come onto this. So he's traversing the fields of Rawruff like a nomad and taught people how to use farming equipment. They say he earned his money. There was like a salt and soil quality to him. And he always had a, like you could tell he was like a very industrious bloke, just kept himself busy all the time. And he always had a plastic bag full of charity shop purchases, which was swaying time in the bus and clatter against his knees. There were cassettes of people singing Tudor ballads, engineering books, sort of brick and brack. As an unofficial custodian of local history, he provided a gentle, soothing boredom, which was nice after a manic shift. I thought of him as like a lavender man. He also told me during an unexpected disclosure that he gelled the remaining hairs in his bald pate, or bald pat, is it? So they functioned as like little ant antennas. And stopped him from bumping his head. So he gelled up and had tenors on his head so he wouldn't bump his head. It's like a subtle eccentricity, that a natural part of his personality that wasn't forced or manufactured. Much like the residents, I'd built up a half-formed impression of the man from the slow accretion of biographical details. From snippets he'd tell me during the bus ride. If it was on the Friday, he was travelling back from a church concert and he'd complain that the contralto was reedy or provided a detailed account of why he'd switched to egg mayonnaise. He studied engineering at the University of Liverpool, and in his early 20s, he became a sole care of poorly parents, which continued for most of his life. Lonely cunts, you know, out of step with the world. One occasion he boarded the bus with another man and they both sat in the two remaining chairs at the back of the bus to me. It was always rammed with day tripping elders, and sometimes I just wanted to read, so I ducked down hoping he wouldn't see me, which is a bit horrible. We were in line, I was sitting to his right, the new man was on his left. The new guy was fat and dishevelled, stale, wearing two raincoats, both with broken zippers, erratic Zizekian hair, sort of thin and greasy. And as he commenced the droning, relentless sermon, outboring the lavender man who actually smells like biscuits or dog feet. Lavender man turned to me, rolled his eyes, and quietly muttered, "Oh, he's always like this. Met him on the bus one day. I've never been able to get rid of him." So there you go. That's today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. No, not raucous delinquent laughter or anything like that, but just quite a nice episode, I think. I hope you thought that. Massive love to you all.